Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host, and each week, or each month, in my case, we pick a new book, a new exciting book, and we interview the author of that book. And this week, I'm very happy to say we have Nicholas Walton on the show from Singapore. Yes, Singapore.
Hello there.
Hello, yes. And we'll be talking about his superb book. That was a little joke. Genoa La Superba, The Rise and Fall of a Merchant Pirate Superpower. I can't wait to talk about Merchant Pirate Superpower. And I think I want to be in one. I don't know how I do that. Do I get an eye patch with that? So anyway, Nicholas, thanks very much for staying up a little bit late there in Singapore to be on the show with us.
That's no problem at all.
Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself? I know that you have a really interesting history, so go ahead.
It's almost 44 years of history this month, so I've packed a few things in. I've lived in quite a few places. I'm from the northeast of England, a small town called Newcastle in the very industrial but beautiful part of the world. My parents thought it wise to bring me up in places like Kenya and New Zealand, which is why I don't have the very strong accent that most of my relatives have. And then I moved back to Middlesbrough when I was a certain age and did most of my schooling there. And that's another very industrial part of the Northeast. After school, this is the long version, I suppose. After school, I went up to Oxford to study and ended up not long after that, still dreaming of perhaps going into academia like a lot of the people that you interview. But I ended up going first to Vienna, where I'd lived before as well, and then across to Budapest. And it wasn't long after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I ended up, living the dream with a beautiful Hungarian girlfriend who drove a Trabant, of course, living with the icebergs floating down the River Danube and earning a very small amount of money, writing for a local radio station. I thought, well, why would anyone want to do anything different to this? So I went back to Britain, and lo and behold, I ended up working for the BBC through a series of very, very fortuitous sort of events. And that led me to a 14-year career where I basically specialized in foreign news. I worked for the BBC World Service, which I still think is one of the greatest institutions ever in journalism, and I was very, very lucky to work for it. I was the BBC correspondent in a couple of places, first Warsaw, just before Poland joined the EU, and then in Sarajevo, covering pretty much all of the Balkans from Slovenia all the way down to Greece, not quite Greece, Albania. And that was fascinating. I reported from places like Moscow just before the outbreak of the Gulf War, back in 2003, the winter of 2002, 2003, and ended up making programs from everywhere, Georgia, Massachusetts, actually not far from where you are, Western Massachusetts. I still have my UMass t-shirt was a radio documentary about. I still have my UMass t-shirt and the and that was about hunting in the United States. It was not long after Dick Cheney emptied a shotgun into one of his friend's chests, and that's what inspired that. Even ended up down in Sierra Leone making a documentary with a former white South African mercenary. So I'd been around, and after meeting the woman that was going to be my wife, I ended up moving to a think tank for a few years, European Foreign Policy, and that was the European Council on Foreign Relations. And then around that time, I started doing interviews for News Books Network, Europe especially.
Yeah, there you go.
Did a few on Africa, a couple on journalism and so on. To be honest, I've really only paused that because being out in Singapore, it's difficult to get their time zone right for Europe.
And how?
Exactly. And then shortly after my son was born, ended up in Genoa, where my wife is from, writing a book about the place, which is the book we're about to talk about now. And we're there for a few months and then moved to Singapore, where I've been doing all manner of things, everything from working for Fox Sports Asia, all the way through to writing for everyone from CNN Travel to teaching international relations, and I've just started another book project, but that's I suppose for the end of the interview. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That's where the Genoa bit fits in. It's my wife and that's where I am now, Singapore.
Let me just say two things. The first is, I'm just thinking about that moment in your life at, I don't know, 18 or 22, in which you were considering whether to go into academia or do what you did. And I'm just wondering how you feel about missing the opportunity to sit for hours and hours and years and musty old libraries, and then having to suffer the slings and arrows of an academic life. I'm sure that you probably really regret that a lot.
Well, not long after I came back from Bosnia, I actually signed up to do a postgrad, a master's degree over at King's College, London, at the Department of War Studies.
How long
and
that
it was
last?
All about? It was good fun. I did it full time at the same time as working, so it's pretty intense.
Yeah,
but what struck me was that academic institutions, rather than being this thing that I would have really enjoyed working for, seemed to be just as dysfunctional as the BBC. So I enjoyed doing the course, and I put a big line underneath that ambition of mine, and just continued with what I'd been doing.
Yeah, don't get me started on academic dysfunction.
I scratched that itch, and it's.
I was a professor, and I resigned my position as a professor. I just couldn't really deal anymore. That's my fault, not theirs. But then the second thing I wanted to say, since you mentioned the BBC World Service.
Yes.
I want to put another plug in for the BBC World Service. This must have been like 6 or 7 years ago, and I was a big, I hate to say this, NPR listener. But then I found the BBC World Service online, and I have never gone back, and I listen to it for several hours every day because it is truly the most amazing thing I have ever seen in terms of radio news. It's astounding, the coverage that they give. It's the only place where you can actually get world coverage, and you really get it.
Absolutely. And we used to pride ourselves in the fact that if you had three headlines at the top of the hour, you could have something like, you know, President Obama's been inaugurated. And the second thing could have been some movement connected to the Polisario Front down in Western Sahara. It was literally, if the news was important enough from anywhere in the world, we ran it.
Yeah, that's
and,
really true.
You know, it was spectacular because you had all the different language sections backing you up, and you could just put in a call to the Burmese section or to the Serbian section and get some really, really good advice, whatever the story. So, yes, absolute privilege. And it was actually an ambition of mine to work there. So I count myself lucky.
Yeah, well, yes. You should. And, you know, I've learned more about Africa, let me tell you, because Africa is just a huge blank spot in the United States. And I've learned more about Africa. I cannot begin to tell you. The only criticism I have of the BBC World Service is that they pay a lot of attention to this thing that you call football. And especially English football, like the FA Cup and that other side. I don't even know what that is, but they spend a lot of time on that. Really a lot
but
of time.
The thing is that if you're a taxi driver in Lagos, that's what you really, really care about. You don't care about the Polisario Front or President Obama. You care about the football.
I know that Yaya Toure got passed over for African Footballer of the Year. And so I'm
dummy out of the pram. It was a good story.
And I'm up on these things. For American, I consider that very metropolitan.
Good on you, Marshall.
Yeah. So let's talk about the book. Why did you write the book?
Well, I was very lucky in marrying an Italian. People marry other people from rather bad places of the world all the time. And, you know, I came up trumps because I married a woman from not just a lovely country, but also a fantastic city. And I used to visit my wife's family. I used to get lost in this rabbit warren of old medieval streets, the oldest medieval center in Europe. And then, you know, climb up on the mountains above the great port of Genoa and just sort of idly wish that there was a book that I could pick up and read about it. And when we got the chance to live there just after my son was born, I looked into, was there a book that I could read about the place? And there wasn't. There's the odd travel guide, few academic books. And so, you know, it's not one of these big cities like Rome or Florence or Venice, which was the big medieval rival to Genoa. It's a very authentic city that seems to have gone unnoticed in many ways. It's not a great tourist destination, even though there's a lot of tourists go to places like Portofino and the Cinque Terre and beautiful places like that just along the coast from there. So the next thing I knew when we actually went there and we were living at the top of this old palazzo in the center of in the centro storico of Genoa, and I was sat there with a contract for writing this book, which was brilliant. And I ended up with the spookiest office possible, hidden away up a few dark and dingy flights of marble stairs above this church, right next to where the ghost, one of the famous ghosts of Genoa, a chap called Branco Doria, who'd murdered his father and ended up in Dante's Inferno as one of the major characters in there for his sins. He was meant to hang out in the building just next door. And it was the middle of winter, so it got dark very early, and it was quite a terrifying place to work. But, I started work on it there, and it was very atmospheric and absolutely loved it. And my wife loved the fact that we were researching the city that she'd lived in, and almost taken, like a lot of people in Genoa, she'd taken it for granted.
Oh, yeah.
And we came across so many fantastic stories. I've got to say, I mean, following on from what we were just saying about academia, I'm not an academic, I'm a journalist. So I was approaching it from a journalist point of view. I love history, so there's plenty of history there. But I'm trying to tell stories about the place as opposed to, document that such and such happened in 1571. I'm trying to pick out the big themes of the place and come up with the stories, and more to the point, draw it towards the modern day and try and find people who really represent Genoa and kind of provide some kind of link with the past. So for instance, and this was one that my wife was really delighted to have to help me set up, but there's the whole book starts with an interview with a transsexual prostitute. She was about, she must have been well into her 50s. I mean, of course, everyone in the world at the minute seems to be talking about transsexuals and intergender and all sorts of things. But it seemed certainly to my wife's parents to be quite an odd place to start a book about this city that they loved. But the whole point is that this transsexual prostitute who was in her mid-50s, she basically lived a life that could be exactly the same as what someone was living there in about 1170 or 1570 or 1870 in a magazine or one of these little cubby holes, little hobbit holes hidden away on these tiny little streets zigzagging their way across the port. And it just seemed like the perfect way to kind of describe this city that still lived almost like it was a big medieval city. Yeah. So that's the approach that I took to the book. So, I don't think it'll be included in too many academic libraries, but the people that do pick it up, I hope have a much more vivid picture than you sometimes get about a living city.
Yeah. I mean, I think they will, but let me, historians like to start with, old, I mean, really old. And that would be, in this case, geography. I'm reminded of this is coming up. Usually in some of the classes that I still sometimes teach, there's a sort of moment in February here in Massachusetts and far northern part of this of North America in which I just walk in and say, why do we live here? Because, it's 10 degrees outside and sleeting and there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. So, but Genoa, you really couldn't ask for a better locale. Could you tell us a little bit about where it is and sort of how it's situated?
Well, if you look at the boot of Italy and you go to the northwest corner of it, just where it starts to work its way towards the French Riviera, that bit is Liguria. It's very mountainous. It kind of goes straight out of the sea, straight up into hills, and then very quickly falls away into the Po Valley, and you start hitting all of the big rich centers such as Turin and Milan and so on. So Liguria itself is a bit of a mustache shape, just sitting on this little sliver of coastline. And if you go in one direction, you hit the French Riviera. If you go the other direction, you end up in Tuscany, Pisa, Florence, places like that. But the geography is extraordinarily important. And you talk about it being a beautiful place to live. For the first 1,000 years of after the birth of Christ, it was actually a very, very poverty-stricken place. And in fact, it was the poverty of this very harsh environment. There was nothing really but mountains and a relatively barren sea. So the people there didn't have much. But then in about the 930s, there were so many Muslim raids, Muslim pirates and so on, raiding the coastline, sacking villages, sacking towns, and dragging away people for the slave markets of North Africa, that basically that catalyzed the people there to basically say, okay, well, we've got two choices. We can be victims, or we can get out there. And, we're all used to the sea. We live there. We can go and make use of it. And within a very short amount of time, The Republic of Genoa was founded in 1005. Within a very short amount of time, 1100 or so, Genoa was really on the way towards being a real maritime superpower, a city-state, but a superpower. You know, it ended up controlling interests, you know, starting off in Sardinia, where they started getting involved in the slave trade. They started getting a hold of salt. They started getting a hold of wheat. All of the things that their coastline didn't provide them, they went out and found. And because they were such hard people, you know, Massachusetts, I thought, was a beautiful part. Western Massachusetts, I would swap for living in Western Massachusetts any day. But where they were, they would have swapped anything. But that made them really, really, really hard to live where they did. And Ligurians and Genoese, basically, they were cutthroat sods. They went out, and if anyone was going to do anything that it took to get ahead, it was the Genoese. And that's how they became so successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess we can come to merchant pirate superpower. They have a nice port.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit
they
about
do.
That? Yes.
Well, what do you want to know? I mean, I suppose in the, you know, if it's mustache shaped, where the nostrils are, that's pretty much where Genoa is, half and half either side. And it's got a lovely port. It's surrounded by mountains. There's a kind of bowl shape. The bottom of the bowl now is full of these little vicoli, which is the local word for all of these tiny little alleyways. You clamber through the vicoli. You hope you don't come across the type of person that you really don't want to come across in those places. And then suddenly it'll open out and there'll be a medieval churchyard. There'll be a little palazzo with, you know, the typical Italian scene with one of those weird little tricycle things that they deliver fruit and vegetables to out of the way places. And then you clamber off, and it's only when you actually come out of the port and you start climbing up this, I suppose it's shaped a bit like an amphitheater, and you climb up and up and you start to hit all of the 18th and 19th century buildings that kind of ring the port, and you start to get a sense of what the whole place looks like. Yeah. And then you're looking pretty much south, but you've also got La Lanterna, which is, it's from, if I'm right, the 1500s. But it's this monumental, beautiful, lighthouse. It's almost like an Art Deco version of a space rocket. And it's so extraordinarily tall, given how old it is. And the sun always just seems to set just behind it. So it's a really spectacular place. And, when you go out either direction along the coast, you end up in similarly spectacular places. You've got Portofino, for instance, which is a famed destination of the jet set, this beautiful little cove with these multicolored houses around this beautiful little port. Of course, it's full of very rich people now and shops that you and I can only dream of going into. And then right on the edge, on the far eastern edge of Liguria, when up in these beautiful little villages called the Cinque Terre, which are, you know, perched on rocky cliffs above little bays and harbors. There were little networks of footpaths connecting them all, but unfortunately, because it's such a harsh environment, every so often, especially around this time of year, we're talking at the minute in early January, around this time of year, you often get the rivers and the streams that come down into the Mediterranean from these mountains often turn into raging torrents. So footpaths have been wiped away. Lives have been lost over the years. But, you know, as I said, it's the harshness of the nature that makes it so beautiful. Mm-hmm. But also that drove the people out to go and make their fortunes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I mentioned the port because it's the port and the ability to facilitate a lot of kind of convenient shipping that brings wealth to
yes.
the city, a little bit like, I guess there's sort of a parallel with Marseille. I don't know much about Marseille, but it is a very nice port too. And it's not far from Genoa, really.
No, it's not. It's not. And in fact, if you go along to places like Nice, where Garibaldi was born, the great hero of the Risorgimento, he is in effect Ligurian. The border there is not as hard and fast as some might have thought. And Monaco, which is just on the French side, that started off as part of the Republic of Genoa until a rogue and typically piratical family the Grimaldis, some of them headed off and they captured the Rock of Gibraltar and turned that into a little pirate base. So yes, and Marseille is a little bit further. But I think that by the time you hit Marseille, you're not far away from the Rhone Valley and so on. So it's not quite as harsh. Mm-hmm. I won't take anything away from the beauty of southern France, but it doesn't have that harshness. I mean, literally in Liguria, you have sea and you have mountains. Uh-huh. And just to give you an idea, if you drive from Genoa to the French border, say you're on the way to Marseille or Nice or Monaco, you will go through over 100 tunnels just to reach the border. So you're constantly going in and out of tunnels. The road is just knocked straight through all of these mountains to get there. So it's quite hair-raising because the Italians are not noted for being the best and the slowest drivers on earth. But if ever you fancy, you know, putting your life to the test and your driving skills, I recommend that.
Yeah. No, I think I might actually. That would be good if I could get like a Porsche 911 to tool around, but I don't think anyone's going to give me that. So the book is called The Rise and Fall of a Merchant Pirate Superpower. So it has an arc, a narrative arc. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about the rise of it? You already have a bit, but I guess at the moment at which this enormous – when you build an enormous lighthouse like that, you must have a lot of dough. I mean, that's an expensive project. So how did they get all that dough? Go ahead.
Well, as I said, I'm not going to give the definitive historian's version of this. There's a few very good books out there that people who are more interested in the details of the story can pick up. But broadly speaking, you had this place where they were being raided by Muslim slavers. They realized they had to get out there. They started thinking, well, hang on, if we go to Sardinia, we can get wheat and slaves and salt. And then they started linking things up because they were fantastic seamen. And they were also absolute stop at nothing people. So they were, you know, they were on the very, very thin cusp between being merchants and pirates. And this was an age where you had several city states really, really coming to the fore. You had Pisa, which was the first big rival, Genoa. It joined forces with Pisa. Sometimes it went head to head against Pisa. And then there was Amalfi. There was on the other side of the peninsula in a similar place at the top of the boot, but in the Adriatic Ocean, Adriatic Sea, of course, there was Venice, which itself was starting to link things together. And this was an age where, you know, the Roman Empire had been long gone. The Muslim world was really starting to knit itself together. And, a new medieval economy was starting to rise. You ended up over the next few hundred years with big manufacturing centers and starting to establish themselves, for instance, in places up in the Po Valley and, of course, in places like Tuscany, you know, Florence and some of the places around there. Then you had other commodities such as wool coming down from Flanders and eventually England, places like that. You had all of these different commodities and goods, and the people who were able to get things to other parts of the Mediterranean and to link up with the East were the ones making the money out of this. Uh-huh. Now, this was also the era of the Crusades. You had the First Crusade where several prominent Genoese families took part. They were given very, very handy concessions. The Embriachi family or Embriachi, my wife always tells me off for pronouncing it wrong and I can never work out which way it is. There was a period when, an anecdote to chuck in, there was so much internecine warfare within Genoa, so much backstabbing and so on, because this, as I said, it was full of very violent, desperate people. That at one point you were using siege engines against other families within the city walls. I mean, this was, if you went outside the area of your family, you basically got a knife through the shoulder blades. And they started building these enormous towers to combat each other. And the only one that, eventually there was a statute to clamp down on all of these civil wars. And that basically said, you're not allowed a tower above a certain height. The only one that was allowed to remain high and is there still today, belonged to the Embriachi family. And that was simply because they had played such a prominent role in the First Crusade. So leave that aside. So you're linking up with the, you know, with the end of the, with the Muslim world, with all of the stuff coming out of the Middle East, out of China. Eventually, because of rivalry between, for instance, Venice and Genoa, Genoa starts to head up into the Black Sea. This is around the time that the Byzantine Empire is also there. It's running into trouble. And the story of Venice and Genoa is also very deeply linked at this point with both the gradual decline and fall of places like Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire, but also eventually with the rise of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Genoa, as ever, played a spectacularly morally ambiguous role in both of those. And so the Genoese ended up, for instance, bringing commodities like fur and slaves down from the Black Sea, you know, the southern edges of Russia and what is now Ukraine and the Black Sea coast, and shipping them all over the place and, you know, returning with, for instance, alum from the island of Chios, just off the Asia Minor coast. And they a bit like the British Empire a bit later on, they weren't land empires. They were networks of little, you know, concessionary ports. Both Venice and Genoa, for instance, ended up with little quarters in Constantinople, that they used to help trade through the Byzantine Empire. And one thing that kind of demonstrates Genoa's role in the development of this economy that had risen up wasn't quite a vacuum in the absence of the Roman Empire, but you know, it had a few centuries where very little happened, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that really illustrates it is that the Genoese ended up with a few concessions just on Crimea and on the Black Sea coast.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, one of these concessions, the port of Kaffa, is being besieged by the Mongols. This is 1347.
Mm-hmm.
And during this siege, and in fact, they end up with some Venetians even coming to take shelter with them. And when Venetians actually take shelter with Genoese, they're sworn enemies, you know that the Mongols must have been pretty bad. And at some point, the Mongols start dying off. And of course, we know now, looking back, that this was one of the big plague incursions into this part of the world. But what turned this into the Black Death was Genoese trade routes.
Uh-huh.
The Mongols start firing catapults with dead bodies over the city walls to try and infect the people inside. And you know, that's what people say caused the Black Death to cause the plague to take root among the Genoese, but it's more likely to have been rats coming in with fleas on their backs, burrowing under the battlements. And then a few Genoese basically managed to break out in their boats, and they call in first at Constantinople, and then they go a bit further into Europe, and then they call in just off Sicily, and then they end up getting it all the way back into Genoa. And if you look at how the whole of the Black Death spreads across Europe, it basically starts off from these nodes and basically fans out. Mm. And because the medieval economy had reached this point where things were linked, obviously it was a very, very contemporary version of globalization. It's nothing like what we have today. But that's what spread the Black Death through the whole of Europe. And as we know, cost the lives of a third of the people on the continent, especially in those built-up areas such as Flanders and such as Tuscany. So the Genoese were to blame for that. And I suppose that really exemplifies how they played such a central role in the development of the medieval economy.
Uh-huh.
There is a lot of decline. They're just a city state. You have, for instance, the Spanish and the French start getting their acts together, and you know, then they really start putting pressure on city states like Genoa. Genoa, of course, is busy fighting the hell out of the Venetians. And then you've got the threat from the south and from the east, from the Barbary Corsairs. And then the Barbary Corsairs are kind of co-opted into the Ottoman Empire as their naval arm. So Genoa really finds it difficult to survive as a very independent state. And then you have the appearance of for instance, there's this fantastic, probably the most important figure in Genoese history, a grand admiral and a mercenary, of course, called Andrea Doria, a giant of a man, phenomenally innovative, lived to the age of 91, which just gives you an idea of just what a remarkable life he lived. I actually, maybe it's a cheap line, but this historian in Genoa told me that this was what he saw Andrea Doria as, and I thought it was such a good comparison, I kept it in. He called Andrea Doria the Steve Jobs of the Mediterranean, because he was always, he had vision. He wasn't just somebody who tinkered around the edges. He did that with tactics on board galleys, and this was the great era of galley warfare, spectacular time, and quite a bloody time. And he did a lot there, but what really set him apart was his vision for what Genoa could be. And just to give you an idea of the type of thing he did, at one point he was the mercenary commander coming in, conquering Genoa again for the French. And when he was there, he thought, hang on, I really need to throw in my lot with the Spanish. So he waited for his contract to come up, went outside the city, and then came again and conquered it for the Spanish. And basically threw his lot in with Charles V, Carlos Quinto, as they call him in Genoa. And this was the age where the explorers were pushing their way across the Atlantic Ocean. And Genoa ended up making an awful lot of money as the great banker to the Spanish Habsburgs. And so much of the bullion, especially the silver that came into Europe from the Americas, all ended up coming through Genoa, which turned its innovative nature into financial innovation, and then financed all of the Habsburg Wars, which was great, of course, until the Spanish start going bankrupt. Right. And then the Genoese really were facing a time of decline. So that's a bit of a potted history, but it gives you a sense of how this little place was clinging limpet-like onto some semblance of life as the world changed around it.
I'm really glad that you mentioned slavery, because Americans tend to think that proto-Americans, let's put it that way, invented it, or simply thought one day, geez, it might be a good idea to have slaves.
It was part of life.
Yes, it was definitely part of life.
It was an enormous part of life. And, you know, I'm sure that there are some in Europe that would love to point the finger at the Muslim world and say, oh, but that's where it all came from. Of course it wasn't. It was part of life under the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the Persian Empire. And, you know, this is actually a very big bugbear of mine about how people, you know, they focus in on a small detail of the relatively recent past, such as the triangular trade in Atlantic slaves. Uh-huh. Or such as, for instance, you have all of this dreadful relativism in universities at the minute, across what seems to be the whole of the Western world. And at the minute, there's a dreadful rumpus in my old university, Oxford, about the statue of Rhodes, the great British colonial, who Rhodesia is named after him, but he was the great imperial pioneer in southern Africa. And a lot of people have taken exception to this, and they say that they feel oppressed whenever they go near his statue, and they've demanded that it all gets taken down. But if you start on this, you'll never end.
No,
you'll never end. You will be tearing down the pyramids because the pyramids were built with slave labor. Almost everything in the world was built on some form of coerced or coercive labor. If you go back long enough, I was listening to a BBC Radio 4 series called In Our Time. It's brilliant. They've got a history archive. There was one program all about eunuchs. Now, eunuchs, the last eunuch, I believe, I can't remember. I was listening to it when I was in Hong Kong about a year ago. And apparently it was only, you know, a handful of decades ago. But eunuchs were a big part of life. And, you know, men hoping or their families hoping that they would get on in life so that they didn't have to eat, you know, the square root of nothing, which is what most peasants in life have had to do, especially in such an unforgiving place over the 19th and 20th century as China. You know, they used to hand over one of their sons, and their son would undergo the type of operation that would make us wince. In fact, the monasteries in Flanders used to do this for the great eunuch trade in Europe at the time that Genoa was a big slaver. So, you know, these things are throughout history. And if you start to try and work out, you know, if you try and draw a line between present day suffering and what's gone on in the past, it just becomes a very fuzzy line indeed.
Yeah. I mean, it's really as conventional, or was as conventional as, let's say, wage labor is to us. You're going to hire somebody to mow your lawn or trim your hedge.
Yes.
And that's pretty much the way they thought about slaves. You're going to buy a slave, or you're not going to buy a slave. They're kind of expensive. Should we splurge and get one or not? It wasn't a moral question.
Yes. And of course, treating them badly was often not just an option. It was an obligatory thing, because that was the way that it was accepted that you got most work out of them. And, you know, it's an absolute filthy business. I sometimes wonder how many people realize just how damn lucky they are to be living in, you know, the 21st century.
Yeah.
I'm not saying life is easy for everybody. Far from it. But my goodness me, life has been pretty damn shoddy for a lot of people.
Yep.
You know, not, I mean, even the rich people.
Yeah,
you can. I know that you're a big, you're an expert on several early modern Russia.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's fantastic if you're one of the richest people. But my goodness me, it still gets cold, and if you get toothache, you've got toothache, no matter how rich you are.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you mentioned there's very rarely connections to Muscovy or early modern Russia in the interviews I do, but there is one that you did mention. And the Muslims had all the money in the early modern period, of course, and they were also the great merchants. But one peculiar thing about Islam is that you cannot enslave other Muslims. So they had to go elsewhere to get slaves. And again, this was completely conventional. It would be like it's like outsourcing. It's like Americans going to China for cheap labor. So what they did was they went to the Black Sea. There were lots of Russian slaves, and they were sold by Italians. Now, that wasn't all the Italians did. I mean, we can't, you know, that's not very nice. The way that they're often remembered, usually remembered today, is if you go to the Kremlin, you'll see that much of the Kremlin was built by Italian architects who were from this Black Sea area, which had gotten wealthy because of these Russian slaves that were sold to Muslims. So,
well, most of the Italians on the Black Sea were Genoese. So
So you go to them. I was going to say these. You know, the Russians. People think of Russia as an ancient place, and it's sort of, everything is autochthonous, and everything's indigenous, and so on and so forth. But it's really quite. If you look at the Kremlin with, you know, Italian eyes, it's very clearly a Renaissance building built by Italians.
it's a beautiful place.
Yeah, it's sort of funny connection there. So, let's try to move. We're not running out of time, but we're a little bit short on time.
We're disappearing up a few cul-de-sacs.
Yes, we are. So this is all very fascinating. So tell us a little bit about modern Genoa, and then it became big. It became a center of the shipbuilding trade, right, in the 19th century.
Yes, I mean that really jumps quite a long way ahead. I suppose just to run through kind of what happened in the meantime, you have a lot of explorers. You have people like Christopher Columbus. He was Genoese, and you know, I think that he quite scared the Spanish with his interest in slaves when he first turns up in Hispaniola. He was very Genoese, even though he didn't live much of his life there. And then you end up with Genoa being a bit of a backwater. But because of its position, it had a lot of very, very well-known grand tourists coming through. It had there's a few streets in Genoa. There's one street in particular that inspired Peter Paul Rubens to write a whole, you know, to do this glorious illustrated book of what he thought was pretty much the ideal street. And he went back and he built his own home based upon what he saw in Genoa. So, you know, there was still money knocking around, but the whole place was largely in decline. You have Charles Dickens, for instance, give some of the most extraordinary, vivid descriptions of what this place is like when you start hitting the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. I remember the one thing that he said, he described the smell of parts of it being a bit like old cheese kept in warm blankets, which when you see the, you know, the Vicoli today, they look so medieval, and obviously they don't smell half as bad as that, but it doesn't take much imagination to imagine what it must have smelt like. So then I suppose the next stage that you had was the Risorgimento, the coming together of Italy was done under four main people. First of all, you had Garibaldi, the great dashing hero. As I said, Ligurian, born in Nice, You also had Matt Sini, who was the big philosophical guy behind the Risorgimento, and he was born in Genoa. And then you had a couple of people from up in Turin. You had Victor Emmanuel, the monarch, the Piedmont monarch, and you had Cavour, who was his prime minister, who was the great political schemer. So basically, Genoa played an enormous part as the midwife of modern Italy. And famously, when Garibaldi set off for the south with his 1,000 men, he set off from one of the suburbs of Genoa called Quarto, where there's a big statue there now. So basically, Italy all comes together. And the next part of the story is that Italy comes together, but it's still a dreadful place to live. And in fact, in many ways, it's worse for a lot of the southerners. So you start off with this enormous flood of people escaping Italy and heading off across the Atlantic to the United States, to Brazil, and to Argentina. And a good many of them went through Genoa because it was obviously such a major port. So Genoa then starts playing this enormous role in the great transatlantic migration story. And especially when you go to places like San Francisco, you come across a lot of people with Genoese ancestry. I think one of the most prominent is Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat politician. I think she's even been back there to pick up some kind of recognition. The Bank of America, for instance, was set up by a Genoese chap after the San Francisco earthquake, I believe. And Del Monte, I heard, was also another Genoese Del Monte fruit. So, you know, the Genoese were pioneers. In fact, Garibaldi himself, he did a lot of smuggling down in Brazil with a lot of Ligurians. And at one point, he was even a candle maker in Staten Island, following the same path of, you know, going across to the United States, or what was the United States, of course. It wasn't a colony by that point, to make their fortune. And he, of course, got bored, came back and incited revolution and looked extremely dashing as he did it. Genoa then becomes part of the industrialization of Italy. The Suez Canal opens up in, I think, about 1861 or something like that. 1869. And that then revitalizes the Mediterranean. The British realize that there's such a lot to be gained from Genoa as a very good port. They turn it into a coking station. A lot of things such as insurance and other services start to develop in the port. Links up with Turin and with Milan in what they call the Industrial Triangle, and it's the shipbuilding hub. And just to go back, as you mentioned early on in the interview about football, the English actually introduced football to Italy through Genoa. And in fact, one of the city's two teams, which is the oldest in Italy, is still called today the Genoa. Note the English spelling, not Genova, as fans would say. Genoa Cricket and Football Club. So you know, it plays a pioneering role there. When the fascists take over, you know, the being able to stand toe to toe with, you know, the great industrial powers such as Britain and France and the United States is a great matter of prestige for Mussolini. So, for instance, you have the great liner, the Rex, captures the Nastro Azzurro, the blue ribbon for the fastest crossing of the Atlantic. And that was in the 1933, I think. So it was a place that continued to be one of the great hubs of Italian industry. Not so much touched in the Second World War, although Ezra Pound, the poet, broadcast some pro-fascist propaganda from a small town just along the Ligurian coast from Genoa until the American military intelligence invited him in for a few chats. And then in the post-war period, and this is part of, you see, for me, with an Italian wife and a half Italian son, this is a very important part of the story for me, where Italy is now and where it's going. After the Second World War, obviously, Italy was still a very poor country, and the West was determined that it wasn't going to turn communist. This was the year of the Marshall Plan and so on. And Italy had an astounding economic takeoff after the Second World War. At one point, I think it spent a decade or two, and it was the third quickest growing economy in the world, or fourth after places like South Korea and Japan. Uh-huh. And by 1986, there was an event called the Sorpasso, where it overtook the British economy to become, would that make it the fourth biggest in the world? And, you know, they believed that it was, you know, obviously you had all the white goods, you had refrigeration, you had Fiat cars, you know, Pirelli tires, all of these things were being churned out. And Italy looked as though it really was, you know, on the up. And the one of the chapters of the books towards the end dwells on this period, you know, the late 80s and the early 90s. And again, to return to that subject of football, soccer, I remember the heyday of Italian football, which was in this period. And it was the richest league in the world. You had every single glamorous player just yearned to play for an Italian team. And Sampdoria, who were the kind of second team of Genoa, ended up with a succession of very glamorous people playing for them. They were quite a small and fashionable team beforehand, but they ended up winning the league and reaching the European Cup final in this period, 1991, 92. And that was kind of the way in which Genoa represented the post-war miracle and its peak. And of course, now we see how Italy, you know, the Euro crisis, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of and understand that Italy is a country with very, very serious problems for the future. When we lived there, we had a lot of people, the younger people that we met, anyone with any talent seemed to be desperate to get out to get to places like Britain and the United States and Australia to see if they could seek their fortune somewhere with more promise for the future, which was quite heartbreaking. You have this rabble-rousing politician called Beppe Grillo, former comedian, and his three-star movement. Five-star movement, slip of the tongue, ended up capturing a third of the vote in recent elections, going back 2-3 years. So basically, Italy now is a place with a lot of questions over it. And again, I think that Genoa kind of exemplifies what Italy is about. It's not a tourist spot. It's not Florence or Rome or Venice. It's somewhere with a real life and with a real history. And that's kind of where I end up in the book, just asking, well, what does this mean for the rest of Italy? What does this mean for the Italians? And what does this mean for Genoa and its future?
Uh-huh. I mean, the reason I originally mentioned the shipbuilding industry is it seems to me the city made a very successful transition from basically a merchant republic to an industrial republic, which not every city did.
Yes, I mean, I think it's also fair to say that there were a few grim centuries in between.
Yes, absolutely.
It wasn't. I mean, I'm living in Singapore at the minute, and they've just hit their 50th anniversary as a quite astonishingly successful place that's transitioned from one part of from one economic level to the next, and is now the third richest place in the world. So, you know, it's nothing like as smooth as it could have been, and I think that. You know, it still remained a very, very grim place to be for many centuries. Yeah. And, you know, the heyday going back to the, you know, the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, for many years seemed a long, long, long way away.
Uh-huh. We're really out of time, but let me ask a couple more questions just because I'm interested in their sort of contemporary affairs. Number one, is there a Muslim population in Genoa?
There is a small one, but this is changing all the time. Thanks to what's happened in Libya, you've got an enormous number of North Africans, but not just North Africans, you know, Nigerians, Senegalese, many of whom are Muslim, coming north and trying to get across to Italy because it's such a short jumping off point. So you've got many, many more people coming up through Italy. This has obviously been overtaken by the Syrian story coming through Greece, but it's still very, very significant. And that's changing things. Now, Genoa itself, being a port, has always been much more open, much more multicultural, because Italy generally isn't that type of a place. It's not like going to London or New York. You've got significant parts of the city where you get a lot of Muslims and other immigrants. And to be honest, they're quite well integrated there. You know, I started off talking about this transsexual prostitute. You go around and it seems as though one street is just Senegalese prostitutes, the next one is Bolivian prostitutes and so on. So I suppose that's a Genoese scale of how well integrated different populations are when they have their own sections of prostitutes.
Yeah, I was thinking about Marseille again, which I think is, I don't know for a fact, but I think it's the most diverse place in France.
Yes, but of course the French... The French had Algeria,
and
Morocco, etc., which is the big difference between the two.
So, is there any Have the Genoese had any, I don't know what to say here, interaction role with, I don't know, the immigration crisis from Syria and elsewhere, Libya, these places?
Well, a lot of these people have gone through, but, you know, on their way, for instance, to France and up through Austria and so on into Germany and Britain and so on. But significant populations have gone before. And I do get the feeling as though they're still very much apart in a way that they aren't in. I'm talking about migrants in general. It's still a not as multicultural a place as other parts of Europe. But on an Italian scale, Genoa does have significant populations that are fairly well integrated. One of the guys that I mentioned in the book is a chap called Rashid, who's a Moroccan, and he's what they call a frutti vendolo, a fruit and vegetable seller. And we always used to go in there, and he's one of those absolutely lovely people who puts a smile on your face whenever you buy some tangerines off him. And we asked him why he lived where he did, and he'd actually tried to live outside the center, but because he comes from Morocco, which is the country where you have Marrakesh and Fez and Meknes and all these other medieval places, he felt as though he had to live in the very center because it made him feel as though he was part of this enormous bustle that he was used to. And he's, you know, someone like that is as well integrated as anyone that you'll ever come across. So to some extent, yes, but everything, you know, you're looking at little details of the big picture.
Uh-huh. And then finally, of course, Genoese football. We have to mention that they've kind of fallen on hard times, haven't they? They're not
well.
They're doing very well.
They're both in Serie A. Yeah. Genoa.
Are they really? They're in Serie A. And Sampdoria. Really? I didn't know
Genoa
that.
Genoa. Huh. Genoa are in all sorts of trouble and look as though they might go down. Really. Sampdoria has just beaten them in the what they call the Derby della Lanterna, uh-huh. named after the lighthouse, which my father-in-law was very pleased about. I went along to the Genoa Sampdoria Derby just before I left, and it was one of those things that just makes you feel good about football. It was a beautiful occasion.
Oh, yeah.
The fans mixed together. There wasn't any of the nastiness that you do get in some places. I mean, if you go to Roma Lazio, you'll end up with, you know, little puncture marks all over you.
Right.
All over you. So there was a real sense that you know, in Genoa they get on with their own thing, and there's a bit of rivalry, but you know, they'll see it on the football pitch, they'll blow up fireworks and hold up banners and all sorts in the ground, but you know, it's friendly.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely way in which to leave the city to go to the derby. And of course Sampdoria won 1-0, so my father-in-law was delighted about that as well.
That's great. So, I didn't know they were in Serie A. I didn't. No, it wasn't.
Both of them are, and both of them did very well last year, and this time not so well.
That's good. Well, anyway, okay. Enough about football, or soccer, as we say over here. So, I want to thank you very much for writing this book. It's fascinating. We've been talking with Nicholas Walton about Genoa La Superba, the rise and fall of a merchant pirate superpower. It's a terrific book. We always close our interviews, as you know, or at least I close my interviews by asking people what they are working on now. So I will ask you that now. What are you working on now?
Among the many things that a freelance journalist writer has to work on, I have just agreed to write a book on Singapore. So it's going to hopefully be a journalist's book about the place, you know, with a lot of color, all of the things that you never quite knew about the place. But because Singapore has such interesting questions about how this tiny little red dot in Southeast Asia not only has managed to survive, but has become, you know, the world's third richest place without any natural resources other than its people. it's quite an extraordinary story. This last year, the great architect of this, Lee Kuan Yew, died, and we also had the 50th anniversary of independence. So this is a time where I think it's very, very valid to ask those big questions. I think that the place is really quite fascinating. So I'm hoping that it's going to be not just a good read, but also beg quite a few questions about how small city states, such as Genoa, Singapore, and so on, have a place in this world of ours where we seem transfixed by size. You know, it's all about the size of China and so on, big trade deals. But for this little place to have done so well, it should be quite a good story.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sounds fascinating, and we'll have you on again. I have to ask this question. Do you have any idea where you're going to go next?
It depends upon... You see, this is the great secret. My wife has a great job. She earns quite a bit of money, and that meant that it's not a massive amount of money, but you know, it means that I've been able to start to develop a career, because you try and get two people with careers and try and keep them together, and you know, you have to live in London or New York or something like that. Yes. And we're lucky. We can, you know, 2 years once the contract's over, we can really start to look around and decide where to go next.
Yes, I mean, I can agree with the two career thing, because I won't say I gave up my career, but I realized that raising children takes a lot of effort, and two careers is really, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean, I work, but I kind of work at my own pace.
Yes. And to the point, you're a bit like me. You can actually, you can carry your work wherever you go, thanks to the magic of the internet.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So that's hopefully how we'll do it in the future. But you know, never say never. We could end up anywhere.
Yeah.
My vote is for Western Massachusetts.
I gotta tell you, that would be hilarious. I would love to have you out here. It'd be terrific. Wonderful. All right. Well, yeah. Nicholas, thank you very much for being on the show. Okay.
That's no problem at all.
Okay.
Thanks, Marshall.
All right.
Have a good day.
Bye bye.